This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Money. Some people say it makes the world go round. Others, perhaps some of them are the same people, who knows, say it's the root of all evil. Today on Movies on the Radio, we are featuring your favorite films about money. Even before movies had sound, filmmakers were tackling that theme, and they continue to this day. The almighty dollar was at the heart of several recent blockbusters as well. Film experts Laura Boyes and Marcia Gordon are here. Laura, the film curator for the North Carolina Museum of Art. Marcia, film professor at North Carolina State. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much.
See the paymaster on the way out.
Thank you.
It's going to be a great show.
Finally.
This is it. I mean, they've been doing films about money. We're going to hear about greed in just a minute, right? From the beginning, Laura.
From the very beginning, because money, of course, is what made Hollywood go round from the very beginning.
Well, not to mention American culture, so American society. So films that grew out of the American film industry were, I think, necessarily part of the system in which we live, which is driven by capital.
It is. And, you know, when you think about the very earliest days before Hollywood was Hollywood and where the Nickelodeon was a place where working class people went to see films about themselves and about working life in America, which had all the horrors of capitalism built into it, that was the stuff, you know, originally.
And that it was named after money. It was a Nickelodeon.
There you go. It's very named. Well, let's talk about, we're going to talk much more about many of the themes that show up in this, this topic of money. But why don't we listen to our first caller and our first film?
My name is Lyle Murdler. I'm from Cleveland, Ohio. And greed was top of mind for me because in high school, many years ago, I read the novel McTeague, on which the film was based. And the novel made quite an impression on me. I enjoyed the novel a great deal. Later on in college, I happened upon a large format paperback book of the film, which was made in 1924, a silent film. And I also enjoyed this book reading. The whole story is told in stills from each pertinent scene, and it also had production notes in it. I've always enjoyed the story, very compelling about people who win a lottery and then try to improve their lot in life by investing in gold, but everything goes wrong in the end, and it does not work out well.
Lyle Murdler and the film Greed, 1924.
So this was directed by Eric von Stroheim, who, if anyone knows his name today, it's because he plays the butler Max in Sunset Boulevard. But he was a very famous silent film director who was usually obsessed with the sexual decadence of the upper classes. But yet his lifelong obsession was with this naturalistic novel about people just struggling to survive in turn of the century San Francisco.
A powerful novel. Obviously, it turned it turned Lyle on.
The Frank Norris novel, if you've never read it, is a wonderful read. And this film's extraordinary. The story of this film, too, is that it was originally something like 9 hours, which, of course, you're not going to release or you're crazy as a studio. So it was completely eviscerated, and there's no cut down, and then there's no extant copy that survives of the original form. But what I love about this film, and we're going to hear this a lot today and think about this, is that we think of money often as solving all of our problems, right? If we just had enough, everything will be fine. And over again, the stories that we're told in movies is that that is not the case. And in fact, money is incredibly destructive. And I just went back and I looked at the opening sequence to this film, and it starts with a poem on screen that reads, "Gold, gold, 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 bright and yellow, hard and cold, molten, graven, hammered, rolled, hard to get and light to hold, stolen, borrowed, squandered, doled." And that kind of obsession with the idea of money and then all the ill-gotten ways that you pursue it, that's kind of the story of money in film in four lines.
And there's $5,000 that was won on this lottery ticket, but one of the characters becomes so obsessed with just keeping it that it's never used. You know, it's just the obsession of having it so that it has no No currency, as it were.
Right. So what is money for? What is the value? Right. Is it hoarding it and putting it under the mattress, or is it what it can get you?
Well, because of the way we glorify money, right, that it becomes a fetish. So the thing, it's the thing itself. And it is a commodity. You can actually trade in the value of money, which distorts all of the markets, right? And so you have these built-in distortions, both economic, financial, and psychological. And when it becomes a fetish, now it's utterly useless. It's like the dragon that steals the gold and can't spend money, and
right.
steals the virgin and can't do that either, yeah. as far as I know. With yeah. dragons, I don't know. I've never been with one.
The photography was very innovative in black and white, but it was tinted, so all the gold sparkled gold on screen.
Throughout the film, and it's a stunning film.
That's the film Greed. It was a silent film in 1924. Grapes of Wrath, a little bit later film, and a very serious treatment of money.
My name is Chris Kelly. I'm from Raleigh, North Carolina, and my pick was The Grapes of Wrath. The movie is wrapped around the whole idea of not having money or not having jobs and going to California to because they've heard that there are jobs there.
Could you see your way clear to sell us a loaf of bread, ma'am?
This ain't a grocery store. We got bread to make sandwiches with.
I know, ma'am. Only it's for an old lady. No teeth. Got to soften it with water so she can chew it. She's hungry.
Why don't you buy a sandwich? We got nice sandwiches.
Well, I sure would like to do that, ma'am. But the fact is, we ain't got but a dime for it. It's all figured out. I mean, for the trip.
You can't buy no loaf of bread for a dime. We only got 15-cent loaves.
Well, it may sound funny being so tight, but we got 1,000 miles to go, and we don't know if we'll make it.
The other big scene, I think, is when they go in hopes to a migrant camp in hopes of work, and they actually get work, but they find that all the prices for the goods rob them of any profit or any money that they would have for themselves. And that when they come across unionizers, that one of the unionizers are killed, and that really gives Tom the impetus to try to unionize the area.
Wherever there's a fight so hungry people can eat, I'll be there. Wherever there's a cop beating up a guy, I'll be there. I'll be in the way guys yell when they're mad. I'll be in the way kids laugh when they're hungry and they know supper's ready. And when the people are eating the stuff they raise and living in the houses they build, I'll be there too.
Henry Fonda in The Grapes of Wrath, a 1940 film.
Well, this is a phenomenal film, of course, based on the Steinbeck novel that we all have read at various points in our lives, first off probably in school. But in that first scene that we heard in the diner, the waitress at first is very kind of brassy, and she's clearly sick of seeing these people come through, not have enough money. And she kind of a switch flips for her when she's going through this exchange over this money, and these two kids, the two Jode kids, are like looking at this case of candy, and the father asks, Pa Jode asks, you know, like, how much is that candy? And she says, 2 for a penny. And so he buys the kids. He has no money, right? Buys the kids this candy because they're just looking at it like it's everything in the world. And then when they leave, it comes out that a truck driver says, you know, that's 5 cents a piece candy. And she goes, you know, shut up. You don't know what you're talking about. The truck driver gives her extra money. So it's all about kind of becoming more empathetic and human in the face of this national economic catastrophe told through the story of an individual family.
And when the Jodes, along with everyone else, they're thrown off their land by the banks who are repossessing the farms because of the Dust Bowl, and they're standing there with their guns trying to figure out who to threaten, and, well, you know, the bank is in Tulsa, and, you know, they really don't care about you. And so this one farmer says, well, who do we shoot? Because there's right. really no one even to blame.
Yeah, that's it. I think the novel certainly, and the film to a large extent, is faithful to this idea that individuals, if you let them get together, even if they, you know, as you say in that restaurant scene, the compassion that an individual will feel for another individual, if you allow them to be together in the same room, will emerge. The institutions of capitalism, the banks and the rest, are absolutely things that have to be organized against and will provoke violence because of the destruction that those institutions cause.
I mean, is that not the great tension of society today?
Sure.
and through, you know, through all time, is that the corporate interests are completely at odds with individual needs and difficulties. And so that's solve that, Frank, and
we'll do
it.
We've got another 45 minutes, and in that time, I am counting on the two of you, our listeners in these films,
okay,
to do just that. Movies on the Radio, talking about money. Marcia Gordon, Laura Boys, and that's our theme today on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Much more to come. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, talking about money on Movies on the Radio today with Laura Boys and Marcia Gordon. And this one has come to mind for many as a film that deals directly with the themes of money and greed.
It's John Munson. I'm calling from Raleigh. I'm going to recommend the 1948 film, The Treasure of Sierra Madre.
Badges? We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
It's a film from 1948, 70 years old. It's directed by John Huston. And the main character is Dobbs, played by Humphrey Bogart. And there are a couple of, he and a fellow named Curtis, are a couple of impoverished American expats in Mexico who sort of go off on a gold hunt in the Mexican wilderness with an old prospector. And lo and behold, they find gold.
Expect to find nuggets of molten gold. It's rich, but not that rich. And here ain't the place to dig. It comes from someplace further up. Up there. Up there's where we got to go. Up there.
But instead of it being a windfall for the three of them, Dobbs becomes gradually more and more paranoid and sets in motion a series of actions that leads to his death and no one getting the gold at the end.
Treasure of Sierra Madre.
So often the tales are about getting it, having that glorious moment, and then trying to figure out how to keep it. And the moral of the story over and over again is you don't get to keep it and you don't get to enjoy it. It's so much about the kind of hunt and the fantasizing and the fighting for what you have to do to defend it, and then it disappears.
Because why do you want it? I mean, that's something that is often not reflected upon.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, we'll get to talk about some gangster films, and I'm doing a class this semester, and we're on the gangster unit of the class, and so often it's about seeing other people's signs of affluence, the car, the clothing, the restaurants, the lifestyle, and thinking, I want to be just like that. I'm going to do what I need to get that, and you can never get there.
Also, but we're going to see a number of sympathetic characters who really did need money, or who
right.
we sympathize with and say, you know, it's kind of, yeah, why not? Wouldn't it be great if this poor guy was able
to pay his mortgage. And
then, of course, everything goes haywire. Well, let's talk about a comedy that takes a look at, I think, a lighter version of this, although many of the same themes apply.
My name is Carolyn Kessler, and I'm calling from Cary. And the film that I chose is How to Marry a Millionaire. And the three primary actresses in it are Marilyn Monroe, Betty Grable, and Lauren Bacall. And they start at the beginning of the movie with this great plan that they're going to find millionaires in New York City, and they're going to marry them.
But it's different with girls, don't you think?
How is it?
Well, you know what they say about girls who wear glasses.
What are you talking about?
Men aren't attentive to girls who wear glasses.
Did you ever try it? You brought them with you, didn't you?
Yes.
Then why don't you put them on and find out for yourself?
With you?
Why not? Now, look, if you're worried about me, I'll tell you right now, before you put them on, I already think you're quite a strudel.
Honestly?
Absolutely. I've thought so from the first minute I saw you.
Well, if you really think so...
Go ahead, put them on. You're crazy.
No.
You look better with them on.
I do?
Gives your face a certain, mystery.
No kidding.
They rent an apartment that they can't afford, and... they end up dating several men throughout the film, thinking that they're millionaires. And at the end of the movie, Lauren Bacall's character, Shotzi, she's actually engaged and in the midst of her wedding to her Texas oil man when she backs out and ends up marrying who she refers to as a gas pump jockey, who he actually ends up being a millionaire without them knowing it.
There it is, How to Marry a Millionaire, 1953. By the way, I may lose my job for this, but I think you're both a couple of strudels. So I just want to say that.
Aw, that's the nicest
that's really
thing
sweet.
Anyone's ever said to me.
What about that?
This, of course, speaks to the fact that women are economically disempowered mm-hmm. in this era, and that the only way to get any yep. sort of agency in your life is to spend your husband's money.
And yet, of course, this is also a comedy. Right. And as such, I mean, some of the lines, one of my favorite conversations is Marilyn Monroe is talking to Bacall, and she says, I want to marry a Rockefeller. And Bacall says, which one? Monroe, I don't care. You know, like this idea. I mean, it's not played just as a serious, kind of, this is the only way that you can advance your life. I mean, that's the basis of the plot, but it's done in a farcical way.
It does come at a time, though. Again, this is a comedy. It's a farce. It's a lighthearted romp through the lives of these women who are looking for money. But it comes at a time when we've talked about this before on the show, in these early 50s, the post-World War II era, men were really afraid of women in a way. A lot of films about women implicating men in rape, in violence, in theft, picking up a hitchhiker, the innocent man mm-hmm. who is somehow made a victim by the scheming woman. That a lot of films in the early 1950s were on that theme, and much more serious than this.
Well, the thing about this film is that the three leading men opposite these women, they're definitely less starry, more B-picture actors. Yeah. So the women have such power in their stardom, they kind of overwhelm the men that they're supposed to be attracting. It's a very weird kind of Hollywood-y balance.
Yeah, and I mean, there are a lot of films from the 1950s in particular about this idea of the gold-digging mm-hmm. woman. And actually, that is an idea that goes back to the 1930s
yeah.
in particular.
20s,
and
yeah.
But then often that's undermined, that ultimately the women tend to have purer hearts than just the money-grubbing
And opt, in this case, for true love over wealth, and then find out later they can have both.
Right.
True love and wealth. That's a very well-known film.
It's a perfect world.
This, see, we did it in less than 45 minutes. Oh, but things are going to go bad again. Let's take a look at a lesser-known film.
My name is Roger Ackman, and I chose the 1956 movie by Stanley Kubrick, The Killing, as the money scene film, because I find not only the ending scene, which is one of the most spectacularly, the losing the money scene in the film history, but I think the film is layered and it is heavily focused on the money, not only at the racetrack and also the characters involved in trying to handle this heist.
It's 7:15.
Don't worry, you get here. We got to pick up the dough at the motel where I dropped it. It was a funny little guy named Joe Piano there. He runs the place, I guess. Sure hope Johnny knows how to pick his friends.
Why ain't he here? Everything else runs on a timetable till it comes to paying us our shares. And the timetable breaks down.
I think I hear the elevator.
That'll be Johnny.
Yeah. Quiet, everybody. Up.
What is this?
It'll be a massacre if you don't keep those mitts up. Now, where's Johnny? What time's he due?
I'm gonna give you a bum steer, buddy.
Hey, where's the jerk? Where's George?
The jerk's not...
In many ways, it is a genre-breaking movie. I think Stanley Kubrick is trying to create a multi-layered film of losers, which he takes his precedence from not only the lead actor from The Asphalt Jungle of John Huston, but also this film is a precursor of the end of the studio era and the announcing the coming of directors like Scorsese, Bogdanovich, and Coppola. And it's a very underrated film, but for many people, this is the first mature debut film of Stanley Kubrick, who himself became an auteur.
The 1956 film, The Killing.
Well, I can't agree more. This, to me, is a perfect film in so many ways about people who want to commit this perfect crime. And the final sequence that the caller is referring to is so wonderful because Sterling Hayden, who plays the kind of head of this whole plan, has this suitcase full of money, and he's getting on, trying to get on a plane, and they make him check the bag so he can't carry it on because it's too big, right? Because it's full of all this money. And so the bag, we see it going out on the runway to go onto the plane, and this poodle jumps out of this ridiculous woman's arms, and the driver of the baggage car has to swerve, and the money falls out of the bag as it kind of hits the ground, and it creates this tornado of money that's just going after all of the death and suffering and planning. The money just evaporates into air, and so it's this beautiful poetic ending to the film.
Well, it's doom sent to a very jazzy soundtrack.
Yes,
because from the very beginning, it's like no good can come of it. It's not like there's an option that everyone will live happily ever
You're
after.
Right. Music played a really important part. I was struck by that. I had not seen the film. I was going through the clips and said, wow, you know, this is Kubrick, you know, again, paying a lot of attention to the soundtrack and to the music.
This is a favorite of Quentin Tarantino, as you can imagine.
So. Yeah, well, a lot of violence in that scene where you heard the gunfire. We then linger on the bodies that are strewn about this apartment, and it's pretty ugly.
And betrayal. I mean, that's always part of these films about capers, that one character is going to betray the other out of, again, this kind of preposterous greed. There's so much money, but it's not enough.
And it's the Ralph Cramden-ness of all the other characters, too, right? This is Honeymooners the movie.
Yeah. The Honeymooners by Quentin Tarantino.
There's a lot more blood and gore. But yeah, it's an amazing. Vince Edwards, by the way, who would later go on to play Ben Casey,
exactly,
is in this film. So there you go.
Was this Infinity?
Would you say that this was really the sort of coming out for Francis Ford Coppola? He talks about this becoming.
You're talking about Kubrick.
Or Kubrick. This is sort
of
his first mature film.
Well, I mean, this is a relatively Kubrick. Early career, not his first,
yeah.
But. I mean, I don't know that I would call it like the film mm-hmm. in that trajectory, but it's certainly an important one to me.
All right, let's take a look at another one right here.
I need more money. I cannot swing it on $200 a month child support anymore.
Oh, that's the deal we made when you left me. That's what the court order said.
You divorced me, remember? $200 a month 4 years ago has my kids drinking Kool-Aid instead of milk twice a day.
Do you know what I did today, Louise? I sold a used flea collar to a Cocker Spaniel. Yes. And tomorrow I may take out a cat's appendix, whether he wants me to or not.
You've got to help me. I'm broke. I'm flat busted broke. The house and car payments are due on Monday. I need money.
You know how banks operate. They only lend money to people who don't need it.
There's just got to be some way we can make money.
Why don't we just become hookers and rent a motel room?
We'd starve to death. There's 12,000 college girls in this town giving it away.
There we go. Laura Boyd's pick, How to Beat the High Cost of Living.
Okay, so this is a movie that dates from the beginning of second wave feminism, and it's about these three women, Susan St. James, who was mostly a television actress, Jane Curtin in her first movie after she left SNL, and Jessica Lange in her third film after King Kong. And as you can hear, there's also a very jazzy score here by Patrick Williams. But they think they followed all the rules. As Jessica Lange says, I did what I was supposed to do. I married the best provider that I could stand. And and then when their husbands betray them, they decide that they're going to rob a shopping mall. And it's a very low-tech robbery using a power drill and a shop vac, which makes it much more believable than Ocean's 11, for example.
Man tools.
Yes, and you can rent this on Amazon if you want to see it.
The shop vac or the film?
No, probably the shop vac, too. But yes, it's not the greatest movie ever made, but it has a lot to say about, once again, the fact that women without husbands are economically powerless.
Do they get away with it?
I'm not going to tell you.
Also, the grocery store robbery is funnier than Take the Money and Run, which to me, that bank heist was one of the funniest things ever, where they, you know, they argue over whether it's gun or gub, and he says, no, it's gun. Here, he puts his gun down, he says, no. This is even better because she's checking out. The cashier is checking the items one at a time, not particularly interested. She holds out a gun now, finally pulls the gun out of her purse, and the cashier takes that and puts it on the belt.
$1.19 for a water pistol.
Off it is.
So this, I believe, is being remade, at least in part, as a new television series with Christina Hendricks, which they played trailers for over and over and over again during the Golden Globe Awards.
Well, chronologically speaking, I think this film, I will just say, we are dipping into the 1980s now, which is kind of the golden decade of at least the second half of the 20th century for films obsessed with money.
And films that are obsessed with, and rightly land on, the fact that good people doing everything right can't make it in a system that is stacked against, even today, now, stacked against the middle class.
My name is Ellen Chompy. I live in Durham, North Carolina, and my pick for my favorite movie about that has to do with money is Arthur, starring Dudley Moore and Liza Minnelli. It's an older movie. I'm pretty sure most of your viewers would know it. He is the drunk ne'er-do-well of a multi-billion-dollar family and is under a lot of pressure to marry a woman he doesn't love, because it will unite two very powerful families. And he does not want to do that. And even though he is threatened with having to give up his entire inheritance, he really wants to hang out with Liza Minnelli, who is, as his father put it, a nobody from Queens. And I love this movie because I think it has a very irreverent attitude about money.
It's going to cost you $100.
Let's make it $200, but I will ask you to Simonize my car.
How rich are you?
I wish I had a dime for every dime I have.
I take it this bum will be calling you.
Dad, he's a millionaire.
You have my permission to marry him.
Don't you wish you were me?
I know I do.
Don't you wish you were Arthur? Arthur, the most fun money can buy.
That's from the trailer of the 1981 film Arthur, Dudley Moore.
Well, when we're talking about wealth, we often find that the so-called lower classes have more authenticity than the wealthy do, and they're held up as a paragon of humanity versus the...
Well, and in this case, from what I remember of this film, and it's been a while since I've seen it, it's also, I mean, he's such a kid. It's just this infantile behavior because he's never had to work or fight or struggle for anything. And then that idea of the class-crossed romance, I mean, this has been told so many different ways, usually where it's the woman who is kind of elevated into the upper classes, and the kind of fascination with rich male power.
Talk about cross class and money. Here we go.
My name is David Walser. I am from Raleigh, and my pick for money movie is Trading Places. The reason I picked Trading Places is I saw the movie when it first came out in 1983, and a great John Landis film about social economic status, but also about money and greed. And one of my favorite things about the movie, as I found out about it later, was that it actually inspired a rule in the Dodd-Frank Act. It was known as the Eddie Murphy Rule, and it covered insider trading. And I thought that was an interesting fact about the movie.
But it also provided so many one-liners and stuff I still quote today.
Now, some of our clients are speculating that the price of gold will rise in the future, and we have other clients who are speculating that the price of gold is going to fall. They place their orders with us, and we buy or sell their gold for them.
Tell them the good part.
The good part, William, is that no matter whether our clients make money or lose money, Duke and Duke get the commissions.
Well, what do you think, Valentine?
Sounds to me like you guys are a couple of bookies.
Here we go. Trading Places, 1983.
Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd. I mean, this was such a runaway hit when it came out. And, I mean, it's obviously, it's a very, very funny movie. But I think it's also just about how terrible rich people are. I mean, it really is. And how insane the stock market is. Yeah. And that this is what drives our world.
Well, it's kind of a cross between My Fair Lady and The Prince and the Pauper about changing places and saying that if somebody talks, you know, like a rich person, then they can be mistaken for one. And I watched the trailer this morning and saw it streaming on Netflix, so I know what I'm doing tonight because this is
a really funny movie.
Although I have to, my one caveat is that I remember watching a whole group of these movies in which the female protagonist is a prostitute. And certainly there are other categories that we could make our heroines, but it was a period of time where somehow that just seemed very enticing.
And I would say, too, just as a sort of a note of nuance, is that it's not just rich people, but what this movie and very many others do is say, if you play by the rules and you don't have a lot of money, you're in trouble. And if you play by the rules and you have a lot of money, you can manipulate the system and become richer and richer. And that's going to make you look very ugly because you're doing exactly what Wall Street says you should do. And that's sociopathic behavior. So it's fascinating to see the ways in which the system reflect the humans who play by the rules.
Well, I think even sometimes comedies can show us these things in this case.
Especially comedies.
Money, movies on the radio. There's more just ahead on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacia with Movies on the Radio. Film experts Marcia Gordon and Laura Boys. Laura, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Marcia, film professor at North Carolina State University. And listeners who had lots to say about movies on money.
This is Zoran Samardzija. I'm calling from Chicago, Illinois, and I'm a professor at Columbia College, Chicago. My pick for a movie about money is a French film from 1983 by the great director Robert Bresson. It's called L'Argent, and that translates to money in English. And the reason I picked it is because I think it's one of the few films that treats money as a sort of abstract social force that corrupts us all. If we think about, you know, many of the great heist films we see about pursuing money or a goal, those are often about how greed leads to the downfall of a particular protagonist. I don't want to spoil the plot too much, but it's initiated by two students who forge a banknote and try to pass it off to a shop. The shop, of course, doesn't want the forged note either, so they pass it off to their fuel delivery driveman, who gets caught with the money. And increasingly, his life spirals out of control because of this. So I think it's a film about how someone completely innocent and sort of tangentially related to what initiates the plot is destroyed in a tragic way by money.
L'Argent, a French film from 1983.
This is a fantastic film. And let me also say, I mean, Bresson is an amazing filmmaker. He did a film called Pickpocket in 1959. That's another, like, perfect film about money. But this is a film about really unintended consequences of greed and materialism. And it is a heartbreaking, and I absolutely agree with what the caller has to say about it. And it's also, I think, a film about the failure of social systems to kind of account for these things. It makes me almost think of a film like I Was a Fugitive from a Chain Gang, the Warner Brothers film, where somebody who's a perfectly law-abiding person gets sucked into this world and is made into a criminal by virtue of the system. And the film at hand is the same way.
And the object itself, too. I think of the, it's almost the converse of Mark Twain's short story, The 100,000 Pound Banknote, in which a guy says, here, watch this. I'll take a 100,000 pound banknote to this town. I won't have to spend a dime. I'll just flash it. And the object itself becomes a marker of his wealth, which he doesn't have. And he lives high off the hog and never spends a nickel because the object was a marker to other people. Other films as well? How about this one?
My name is Kim, and I'm calling from New York City, and my pick for this theme of money is the 1988 film Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, starring Steve Martin and Michael Caine as two competing confidence men who are trying to connive a complete stranger out of $50,000. And the two men are trying to convince women to give them money, and they're competing against one another. Steve Martin is a rather gauche con man, whereas Michael Caine plays Lawrence Jameson, who is an incredibly refined and cultured con man.
I'm going straight to Andre and tell him to tear up the check immediately.
Oh, no, you can't. I paid the 100,000 francs in cash.
Damn.
Please don't be mad at me. Well, he said he wouldn't let you leave unless I paid off your loan.
What else did he say?
He told me how you needed that money for your country to help fight the communists. It's just such a noble cause. Oh, please don't be angry with me. Pretty please. Here comes a great man. There's that smile. Daddy says we're going to have the biggest wedding Tulsa's ever seen. When do you think we could fly back?
Perhaps we should go by ship.
Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, 1988.
Well, this is money is the ultimate game because it's a rivalry between these two con men, and they don't really, in some ways, even care about the money. It's like who is the most skilled in extracting it.
Good, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to say, and this is obviously, it is just a pure comedy. I mean, there's no attempt at any kind of commentary. The way that, like, Trading Places, I think one of its the things that makes it so wonderful is that it's both.
Yeah, it's a vehicle for Steve Martin, for sure.
Oh, he's fantastic. Yeah.
Great stuff. Well, Marcia, your pick was Goodfellas, and we're into the gangster flicks now.
Yeah, yeah. So Martin Scorsese from 1990, which I'm sure many of the people listening right now have seen before. And so this is a focused on a character, Henry Hill, played by Ray Liotta, and his entree into the world of the New York gangsters. And I believe the scene that we're going to play, I mean, the way that they make money is by loans, by strong-arming people, shaking them down. And this is one of the confrontations over repayment.
What am I, a schmuck on wheels?
Maury, please. You know, Jimmy, you borrowed his money. Pay him.
I didn't agree to 3 points above the VIG. What am I, fucking nuts?
What are you going
to
do?
Come on.
You're going to fight with Jimmy Conway? He wants his money. Give him his money and let us just get the fuck out of here.
Hey. Jimmy, I'm sorry.
Yeah, you should be sorry. Don't do it again and give me the money. You understand? Give me the money. You hear me? You hear me? I got to come here. Give me the money.
I'll give you. I'll give you.
Hello?
You got it, kid. You got it. Believe me.
I just want to tell you, it took me 6.5 hours to edit that.
That 12-second clip.
That's the airplane version.
Yeah, exactly. Wow. Well, so the gangster film is, you know, as said, I'm doing this segment of a class on gangsters right now, and it's always this wonderful tension between the allure of money, seeing the wealthy gangsters through the eyes of these up-and-coming, aspiring, hungry young gangsters-to-be, and learning the gangster way. And then once you get there, always the disillusionment and the trap of it. And in this case, I mean, Henry Hill and his wife Karen, played by Lorraine Bracco, go from, in their own different ways, from being enamored of this. There's a great wedding scene where everyone's handing them just envelopes filled with money that they're putting in this bag, and she's looking at it like, oh my gosh, I can't believe this, to being completely trapped and destroyed by it. And the classic kind of rise and fall of the gangster.
Well, gangster stories are the flip side of the American dream. They're the exact opposite of the way capitalism is supposed to work.
But they're precisely how capitalism has
does
worked.
Work.
I mean, the
exactly.
Godfather
and the
illustrated
exactly.
that, and you just kill and kill and kill, and then finally you wear a suit and you show up,
you're
and
more
we stop arresting
about
you.
How criminal it is.
You're still a loan shark.
Right,
it's just the shirt and tie have changed.
And when you can keep integrating yourself into society until we get to the 70s, and then when the gangsters change color, all of a sudden we start to get tough on crime.
Mm-hmm.
That's what happened. You know, the, suddenly three strikes and you're out, when there were Italian and Polish and Irish mobsters, well, we just integrated, and that money was laundered. And once it became drug money in the inner city, all of a sudden we got tough on crime. So it's a fascinating, it is a fascinating glimpse into capitalism. Godfather, I think, probably had a better look at that. The other thing about Goodfellas is we just love to hear people talk like that, right? I mean, that's just that.
But you didn't let us.
You want to do your Goodfellas right now?
No.
No, because you can't. The other thing is you can't even start like that without me having to edit you.
It's true.
That's the other part.
And we're all susceptible to that kind of gangster glamour, though. We want the nice cars and the nice clothes and the restaurant meals.
There are other accents in America, and they are represented quite well in the film Fargo.
Hi, I'm Deborah Brogdon. I'm calling from Raleigh, and my money movie is Fargo. This fascinating movie is all about the main character's need for money. We never know why he needs it, but he desperately needs it.
Jerry, we thought you were bringing us an investment.
Yeah, right.
You're saying, what are you saying?
You're saying we put in all the money and you collect when it pays off.
No, I'd pay you back the principal and interest. Heck, I'd go one over prime.
We're not a bank, Jerry.
If I wanted bank interest on $750,000, I'd go to Midwest Federal, talk to old Bill Deal.
He's at North Star.
He's at...
No. See, I don't need a finder's fee. I need... Finder's fee's, what, 10%? Heck, that's not going to do it for me. I need the principal.
Well, Jerry, we're not going to just give you $750,000.
What the heck were you thinking?
He arranges to have his wife kidnapped. Nothing goes right. Several people die, and at the end of the movie, the police officer, a 7-month pregnant lady, on her own, brings in the surviving bad guy using only her pistol, her wits, and her shield. It's a bloody and gory movie, but it's really good.
Fargo from 1996.
Yes, that blood and gore part, I had nightmares about blood on the snow for months after I saw Fargo.
And that was courtesy of the Coen brothers,
yeah.
Of course.
Who are from Minnesota.
And
so
pregnant lady is Frances McDormand in a really wonderful role. And this is one of those everything goes wrong that can go wrong from start to finish in this not at all perfect crime scenario. It's kind of the opposite of The Killing, even though you end up in basically the same place in terms of the plot. And my favorite scene in this film that has to do with money is the scene with Steve Buscemi. He's been shot in the face and he's just like oozing blood, and he's got all of this money in this carrier, in this like suitcase, and he's taking it out, and he buries it with an ice scraper in the snow, and he like marks where it is in this desolate snowy landscape. And then of course a few scenes later he's killed with an axe. He's never going to see that money again, right? Just the kind of futility, right, of all of this effort as things go into this
plus
spiral.
Making an X in the ice is kind of a silly idea anyway. If you think about it, it's a Sven and Oli joke. I'll tell you that one later. I have never been able to pass a wood chipper. In the same way. I've never seen a wood chipper.
I wasn't going to bring the wood chipper.
Stay away from wood chipper.
In quite the same way. Well, this brings us into the post-2008 crash millennium, or the millennial money movies, and here's our first.
My name's Stuart Waller. I'm calling from Raleigh. I picked Margin Call. It's a movie about the collapse of 2008, and it's all about one Wall Street firm and what the people in it are trying to do, because they figure out what's going to happen.
What you're telling me is that the music is about to stop and we're going to be left holding the biggest bag of odorous excrement ever assembled in the history of capitalism.
Sell it all today.
Is that even possible, Sam?
Yes, but at what cost?
If I made you, how would you do this?
Well, you call the traders in for the normal 6:30 meeting and you be honest with them, because they're going to know it's the end either way. And then you've got to come out of the gate storming. 40% done by 10:15. By 11 o'clock, all your trades have to be gone, because by lunchtime, word's going to be out. And by 2 o'clock, you're going to be selling at 65 cents on the dollar if you're lucky. Even if we manage to pull that off, and that's saying something. The real question is, who are we selling this to?
Same people we've been selling it to for the last 2 years, and whoever else will buy it.
But, John, if you do this, you will kill the market for years. It's over. And you're selling something that you know has no value.
We are selling to willing buyers at the current fair market price.
I just thought it was a great cast, great acting. It's smartly written dialogue that's funny and really humanizing, and it doesn't really have villains and victims like a lot of these movies do. It's more about really the how the failures of Wall Street are actually a feature of it that ends up enriching a few rich people regardless. And it has a really bittersweet end.
There it is, Margin Call, 2011.
This was really an exciting movie about something that's perhaps not intrinsically so exciting. And Jeremy Irons, who you hear there, is kind of channeling Scar from The Lion King, you know, as the ultimate evil banker. But even he admits that money is just pieces of paper with pictures on it. It keeps us from killing each other when we want to eat a meal.
And playing by the rules again. Like, right. How do I do this? How do we get into this? And I think it underscores, too, this and The Big Short, which we'll see even in a second, that everybody on Wall Street did know what was happening. The lie afterward was, well, nobody understood. Yeah, they understood. That's why they packaged this junk, because they knew they had to hide the fact that you had bad credit ratings. So they knew they were making junk. They just didn't know when it would all end, and we did.
And actually, the documentary version of this, they're showing at the Carolina tonight. It's called Abacus, Small Enough to Jail.
I think it's at the Full Frame Theater.
It's
check your local listing.
Check the listing. But it's about how the flip side of Too Big to Fail is Small Enough to Jail, and how the only people that were ever indicted for any financial crimes were a small family-owned bank.
And if that doesn't make you mad, I don't know what
will.
Yeah,
that doesn't
Well,
make
let's
you
try
mad.
The Big Short. You're going to get even madder in a second. Here we go.
This is Jessica Gottwalt. I'm calling from Raleigh, North Carolina, and I picked The Big Short. This is a true story set in 2006-2007 about the collapse of the financial market. So a pivotal event in this century's history. And so you're watching it unfold as a group of hedge fund managers and institutional bankers discovers that our entire financial system could collapse under the weight of overvalued CDOs and other derivative instruments. And as they're finding out about this misevaluation, they're thinking through ways they can profit from it by effectively shorting the market, which they did. And we lost, and they made billions in the process.
Somewhere along the line, these Bs and double Bs went from a little risky to dog shit. I'm talking rock bottom FICO scores. No income verification. Adjustable rates. Dog shit. The default rates are already up from 1% to 4%, fellas. And if they rise to 8%, and they will, a lot of these triple Bs are going to zero, too. And that is an opportunity.
So you're offering us a chance to short this pile of blocks. How?
With something called a credit default swap. It's like insurance on the bond, and if it goes bust, you can make 10 to 1, even 20 to 1 return. And it's already slowly going bust.
10 to 1, 20 to 1? No way.
And no one's paying attention. No one is paying attention because the banks are too busy getting paid obscene fees to sell these bonds.
The Big Short.
One of the things I liked about this film, as someone who really does not understand the way these things work, is the explanatory function in this film, which I think bothered some people. But I really liked that it broke out and tried to teach you how these things work. They're so difficult to understand, and it makes such little sense. And, I mean, this is just, I think, an interesting film about how disgusting the whole operation is.
Which is how they make their money.
Right.
They only a few wise guys understand, and then they pretend not to know everything when the house of cards collapses. So this is a good illustration of that. By the way, Abacus, Small Enough to Jail, part of the Full Frame series, showing at the Carolina Theater. Got all that worked out.
Thank you.
What a wonderful hour. We have done it. We've solved. No. We've put our finger on the world's problems. Haven't solved a thing. Here's what we do. So thank you for that. But next time, let's talk about child actors, child stars, your favorite child in the movie. What do you think? Should we do that? We'll do it. Talk about that. Send your picks to SOT@WNC.org. Tweet us at #SOTMovies and find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Thanks so much.
Ka-ching.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The State of Things, produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Jennifer Brooklyn, Robert Kinlaw, Angie Perrin, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director, with Al Wodarski sitting in today. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.